Thanks very much, Christina, for a pretty glowing introduction. See how we go living up to that. As Christina said, I'm going to talk today about the Global Code of Conduct for the foreign exchange market. What I'll do today is update you on where we are with all of that, reiterate why we're doing this, and also talk a bit about how the way forward from here. So let me talk about why is this work going on, and Christina mentioned a number of those reasons. As I said, I think this time last year, the FX industry is suffering from a lack of trust in its functioning. And that lack of trust is very evident both between participants in the market, but at least as importantly, between the public and the market. It seems that some of that lack of trust is actually affecting market functioning at the moment, with people uncertain as to what they can and can't do. So the market needs to move towards a more favourable and desirable location and allow participants to have much greater confidence that the market is actually functioning appropriately. So a well-functioning FX market is clearly very much in the interests of all market participants. That also includes us as central banks, both because we act in the market as market participants ourselves, but also because the exchange rate is an important channel of monetary policy transmission. So in a globalised world, the FX market is one of the most vital parts of the financial plumbing. So the Global Code is aiming to set out global principles of good practice in the FX market to provide a common set of guidance to the market. And I emphasise the word common set of guidance so that everyone has a clear understanding about what the, I won't say rules of the game because this is not a rules-based thing, but what the landscape is. And we're aiming to set out that guidance both in areas where there is a degree of uncertainty about what sort of practices are acceptable and what sort of practices are not acceptable. I think that should help to address that lack of trust as well as promote the effective functioning of the wholesale FX market. So to that end, one of the guiding principles underpinning our work is that the code should be promote a robust, fair, liquid, open and transparent market. We need a diverse set of buyers and sellers, resilient infrastructure, and people should be able to confidently and effectively transact at competitive prices that reflect available market information, so I'd emphasise the word market information, and in a manner that conforms to acceptable standards of behaviour, in the public at large, not necessarily just in the markets. So the work to develop the Global Code commenced in May last year when the BIS governors commissioned a working group of the Markets Committee, which, as Christina said, I chair at the BIS, to facilitate the establishment of a single Global Code of Conduct for the wholesale FX market, and not only to write the code, but also to come up with ways to promote greater adherence to the code. So there are a few important points worth highlighting. First, it's a single code for the whole industry. So one code for the FX industry. And second, it's a global code. It's intended to cover all parts of the wholesale FX industry. So this is not a code of conduct for the sell side. It is there for the sell side, the buy side, non-bank participants in the market, and the platforms. Its breadth is both across the globe and across the whole structure of the industry. It's intended to apply to all aspects of the wholesale FX market. So in the code itself, we actually spell out what we mean by the wholesale FX market. And the only thing, and it, as I said, its coverage is pretty broad. The one noteworthy part of the FX industry to which the code generally won't be applying is the retail market, and that's because the retail market is generally governed by retail-specific regulation in the relevant jurisdiction. So here, ASIC and the consumer protection side of things covers off on the retail market. So I'm chairing this work along with Simon Potter, who's head of markets, with Simon Potter at the New York Fed, who's head of markets there, leading the work on writing the code, and Chris Salmon, who's head of markets at the Bank of England, leading the work on developing those adherence mechanisms. So on our side, on the central bank side, we've got representatives of the central banks of all the major FX centres, drawing on the membership of the Markets Committee, which is basically means we've got the head of market operations in the 15 major currency areas. So pretty much if you rank current FX markets from 1 to 15, we've got someone from all of those, the heads of markets and the central banks of all of those groups on our group. So that means we go from London down to places like Mexico, Brazil, China, Korea, as well as the other major FX centres like ourselves, Singapore, Hong Kong, and the like. So the breadth across the globe is pretty extensive. So given our roles as heads of market, we are all very much interested in the effective functioning of the market. It's very much a global effort reflecting the global nature of the FX market. The work is also a public-private sector partnership. We are not sitting there as central banks writing these rules. We're actually working very much alongside a group of market participants, which is chaired by David Puth, who I assume most of you know, who's CEO of CLS. That group contains people from all around the world, including Australia. We've got Hugh Killen, who's head of markets at Westpac, on the group. And it includes people on both the buy side. We've also got Tony Adams from Colonial on the group as well, representing the asset management industry in Australia and globally. So we've got people from the sell side, the buy side, both corporates and asset managers, trading platforms, ECNs, and non-bank participants as well. So we've got non-bank liquidity providers represented on the group so that their opinion is heard too. So the membership draws from the various FX committees around the world and beyond. So we've got 30-odd people from right across the breadth of the private sector working on this. All of those are involved in the drafting of the code, and so all perspectives are heard at the drafting as well as I'll get to in a minute, in terms of people being able to provide feedback on it. So again, this is not a code written by the sell side for the sell side. This is a code for the whole of the market, buy side, sell side, platforms, non-banks, everyone. So where are we up to in all of this? So at the outset, so the biz governance gave us 2 years to get this done. At the outset, we decided to split the topics we're covering in the code into two parts. So the first phase, which is nearly done, is the material we're putting out in 2 months' time in May. So it covers areas such as ethics, information sharing, or market colour, to be more precise, execution, including markup, as well as the sort of back office side in terms of confirmation and settlement. The second phase, which we're just starting now, covers topics such as governance, risk management and compliance, as well as further aspects of execution, in particular e-trading and platforms, which will include things like last look, prime brokerage, and other features of FX swap, forward and option transactions. One reason why we decided to do some of those topics first, in particular execution and markup and market colour, was that was those areas where we thought there was most confusion and uncertainty out there in the market at the moment, and where the market was looking for clarity sooner rather than later. So let me get one example of this is around information sharing, where many market participants have highlighted to us that they are unsure what information can be conveyed to counterparties and other market participants. So while is it clear, or at least should be clear to everyone, that disclosing the names and details of a client's order book to a counterparty is not acceptable, so that one I think there shouldn't be any grey around that, pretty black and white. Market participants have noted that there is much less clarity around what level of aggregation, say, is necessary in order to convey market colour appropriately. So one thing you'll notice from what I'm saying there, in the code, we are not saying that market or information sharing is completely forbidden, or said it's not regulation, so it's completely unacceptable. Some degree of market colour is appropriate. The question is providing more clarity around what level of market colour is appropriate. So it appears at the moment to us that some market participants are being very conservative in sharing information, and that can have implications for the effective functioning of the market. As I said earlier, our aim here is to have the market functioning effectively and as well as appropriately. So we did actually put out some guidance around about this time last year, actually, from the global FX committees, including the Australian Foreign Exchange Committee. And so that some of that that guidance we put out in what is somewhat clunkily called the Global Preamble, which is available on the Australian FXC's website. We're taking that material and fleshing out quite a bit more. And in the code, we have a number of examples to illustrate what we actually mean. So what is appropriate market colour and what isn't appropriate market colour and why that's so. Similarly, there have been diverse opinions around what is appropriate behaviour in terms of water handling. So there have obviously been some very public instances of inappropriate behaviour around water handling, which have come to light in recent years. But in other areas, the market is seeking greater guidance as to what principles should be followed, including the different standards that apply depending on whether an intermediary is functioning as principal or agent. And we've seen a big shift towards agency execution over the last few years. In part, I think some of that is related to the uncertainty as to what one can do if one's acting as principal. That is one area, the area of whether you're acting as principal or agent, that it was not adequately covered in the pre-existing codes of conduct that the various FXCs have been out there for a number of years in the FX market. And there's an area where we're aiming to provide the sought-after guidance. That said, what we're not doing is writing a procedures manual. Rather, what we're aiming to do is articulate principles that need to be taken into account. Individual firms may then take those principles and reflect them in their own procedures manuals, but we are not going to write you a procedures manual which says, in this situation, this is what you have to do. Our aim in articulating these principles is to provide market participants with the framework in which to think about how they handle things like stop loss orders, for instance. So the emphasis here is very much on the word think, which hopefully isn't a completely foreign concept to FX traders, but anyway. The global code will not provide the answers to all your questions, but it should help you ask the right questions. So in a similar vein, I'll repeat a point that I've made a number of times in the past. One of our most central aims in drafting the code is for it to be principles-based rather than rules-based. And there are a number of reasons why this is so, but for me, an important reason is that the more prescriptive the code is, the easier it is to get around. So rules are much easier to arbitrage than principles. If it's not expressly prohibited or explicitly discouraged, then the historical experience seems to be, well, if it's not banned, then it must be okay. Moreover, and that's not the attitude we want to have in the market. Moreover, the more prescriptive and the more precise the code is, the less people will think about what they're actually doing. If it's principles-based and less prescriptive, then, as I just said, market participants will actually have to think about whether their actions are consistent with the principles of the code. So let me tell you where exactly we're up to in the process. So last week, Friday, actually, we circulated for comment the second draft of that first phase of the code via the various FXCs around the world, including the Australian FXC. That second draft incorporates comments on the first draft that we circulated at the beginning of February. So that we put the first draft around the beginning of February. We got over 1,400 comments on that draft. So we spent the month of February processing those and have come up with the second draft. The comments we got were almost universally constructive, which is good, and very supportive of the whole endeavour, and so I'd like to thank those who actually took the time to provide them. So in writing the second draft, we and the market participants group that David Poof chairs took full account of all these comments. So those who provided them can rest assured we have actually taken heed of them, but in saying that, if you provided the comment, you're not necessarily going to see it directly reflected in the redrafting. Amongst other things, there were 1,400 comments, not all of them were completely consistent. So there was some diversity of views in the code. So we've sought, on some issues in the code, and that was reflected in those comments. So we've sought to incorporate the overall feedback in a manner that best reflects those objectives that I mentioned earlier on in my talk, namely that the code should promote a robust, fair, liquid, open, and transparent market. But for those institutions who provided comments, if you don't see your comment there, it's not because we didn't get it, it's because we had to take into account any number of opinions, including our own. So we've got that second draft out there. We're gathering comments over the next week or so. For those market participants here whose institutions aren't associated with the Australian Foreign Exchange Committee or other global FXCs, if you're interested in having a look at the code, I'm happy to provide people with a copy of the draft and happy to receive people's feedback over the next week or so. What we're going to do is take account of those comments. We're going to provide a revised draft early in April, so in about 3 weeks' time. At that point, there'll be one round of final fatal flaw comments. And after that, what we're aiming to do is seek endorsement by the various foreign exchange committees of a document that we're then going to put out There's a meeting of all the global FXCs in New York on the 25th of May. We are going to put the document out in the public domain with the endorsement of the global FXCs at that point. For example, in Australia, we'll be looking for the AFXC endorsement of the code at our next meeting in early May. And basically at that point, as I said, we're looking for all the FXCs around the world to have endorsed what we've got there and basically just start putting it into practice. So we'll put that first phase out in a bit, just under 2 months' time, or around about 2 months' time. We've already started work on drafting the material in phase two, and particularly the stuff around electronic trading and prime brokerage. So we'll continue with that over the next year, again providing plenty of opportunity for market participants to provide comments to us through the FXC process. So our intention is that the complete code will be released in London in May 2017 at the 2017 meeting of the FXCs. So at the end of that process, for the code to be effective and for it to achieve what we want it to achieve, it will need to be accepted and endorsed by the FXCs and market participants more generally and actually used. That said, when we get to May 2017, the process doesn't really end there, because as the FX market continues to evolve, the code will need to continue to evolve with it, and we'll talk in due course about how that might happen in the future. So this is not going to be a code which is right at May 2017 and then sits on the shelf and becomes increasingly obsolete. The idea is that the thing will be updated on as, you know, to reflect the continued evolution of the market, and particularly in this market space, at least, the market does tend to evolve reasonably quickly. Let me talk about the adherence to the code. So at the same time as we've been writing the thing, we've also been devoting considerable time and effort to develop mechanisms to promote and incentivize widespread adoption of the code by market participants. So clearly that's been an issue with the various existing codes that have been in place in a number of markets for over many years. It's very evident by what's actually happened that while those codes were there, they were often ignored, willfully or otherwise. For an industry code to have value in affirming appropriate norms of behaviour, it has to become effectively adopted in the marketplace. So while adherence to a single consistent code of good practice is widely regarded to be the interest of the market, the global code will be voluntary. As I said earlier, we are working with the industry to produce a voluntary principles-based code of conduct rather than a set of prescriptive regulatory standards. The code will not impose legal or regulatory obligations on market participants, nor will it supplant existing regulatory standards or expectations that exist in the various jurisdictions. There's already, as you probably know, a substantial body of law and regulation that applies to the activities of many market participants, and that actually vary significantly across jurisdictions. This variation, coupled with the diverse nature of FX markets globally, means that a one-size-fits-all approach to adherence is probably not going to be appropriate. So the final framework for adherence that we come up with will need to strike the right balance between respecting the existing diversity across different markets and maintaining consistency with regard to what is, in the end, a global initiative. So in that regard, we've articulated three principles which underpin our overall approach to adherence. So first of all, the adherence has got to be universal. It should apply to all wholesale FX market participants based on the activities they undertake. So it's not going to exclude particular segments of the market, with the exception of retail, which I mentioned earlier. We have been working hard to incorporate the perspectives of all types of wholesale FX market participants into the code, and we want it to be widely applicable across the market. At the same time, it needs to be proportionate. So what activities you actually undertake in the market will affect how much you have to adhere to stuff, in the sense that your size and the activities you undertake, your adherence will probably need to be proportionate and appropriate to that and in the context of your local financial market. So we have to respect that there are differences in the size of market participants. So not everyone can put in place the systems that a large global bank can put in place. We need to be mindful of that. That said, that is not setting a low bar which is going to allow some participants to get an easier ride than others. At the same time, we have to make that adherence transparent. So the mode of adherence needs to be there so people are able to monitor and provide market discipline on that. As I said, this idea of proportionality is not designed to lower the bar. It's just there to reflect the fact that there are different differences in the type and volume of market activities that various market participants undertake across the world. So the concrete details of the adherence mechanisms remain a work in progress. We're actually meeting here in Sydney in two weeks' time to try and really thrash out the last details of those. And we'll have more to say on this when we put out the code in New York in May. But at this stage, our thinking is it's not going to be one single adherence mechanism, but rather a suite of mechanisms. As I said, just to reiterate from a local perspective, from the Australian perspective, we're looking the Australian FXC to endorse what we come up with in this first phase of the code in May. We're looking for the adoption by local market participants. And I said, if you're interested in providing feedback on what we've got out there and you haven't already had the opportunity to do so, I'm happy for you to get in touch with me after this. So let me finish there and say, and I hope it gives you some idea of where we're up to with the global code. A lot of work has been done over the past 12 months to get us to this point and drafting this first half of the document also. There's still a lot of work to be done. The work to date has reflected a very constructive and cooperative effort between the central banks and market participants. Let me emphasise, as I said earlier, this is not us, the central banks, coming, writing a bunch of stuff and then just handing it over and say to the market and say, here, do this. This is very much us working with the market participants to come up with something which is going to work for the market but also deliver it into a place where we all want it to be. All of us recognise the need to restore the public's faith in the FX market and the value of the global code in assisting that process and in helping improve market functioning and confidence in how the market continues to function. So as I said, it's been a very cooperative relationship so far between us and market participants, and I would expect that to continue as we see this process through to its conclusion in May next year. So with that, let me finish there and happy to take any questions or on that from the floor. Okay, thanks. So do you want me to just point to people? Does that work? So has anyone got any questions? Simona's got a microphone as well. Helps. Chris.
Thanks, Guy. Last year you spoke a fair bit more about benchmarks and the operation of particularly the London 4pm fix. Have you seen or can you make any observations on how that may have progressed since that time?
Yeah. A couple of points. So first of all, we talk about order handling around benchmarks as in the code. So we pick up the stuff that was in the recommendations that Paul Fisher and I put out, it must be 2 years ago now, on handling fixed orders. That's exactly reflected in the current draft of the code. In terms of where things are up to on that, just trying to remember, I've lost track of time here. About 6 months ago, I think it was, we looked at how those recommendations have been implemented around the world. Most, but not all, institutions are charging for fixing transactions along the lines that we recommended. The most notable change, obviously, was that the London 4pm window got widened from to 5 minutes. That does seem to have affected the dynamics around that, and we put out some work last year which showed that. It seems, as I said, so that change happened. I suppose the most material change, or the most obvious change to me, is that the way that banks actually handle fixing orders has changed quite considerably. So one of the recommendations we put out was to separate your handling of fixing orders from other orders, and that has by and large happened. And one outcome of that is that we've seen a very large increase in algo execution of fixing orders. So a lot of banks have implemented that by basically having all their fixed orders handled by algos. And that seems to have also affected the dynamics of the trading through the fix. I think initially, at least, some of those algos were fairly straightforward. They looked very much like a VWAP, which is just smoothed, pretty much evenly distributed the orders right across the 5-minute window. I think as that's, people have noticed that, the way, you know, we've started to see more sophisticated, for want of a better word, execution strategies being put in place, still algo executed. So I think my sense is that that's in a better place than where it was. I think most, but not necessarily all, of the outcomes we were looking to achieve with that have happened, at least for London 4 p.m. I suppose I'd make the point that while most of our recommendations have been implemented for the London fix, that's not true of fixes elsewhere in the world where there's probably more scope for improvement, to put it that way. The only other thing I'd note is that WM, who actually runs or owns the London 4 p.m. fix, has now actually set up a user group of market participants so that they are now, market participants are now able to provide feedback as to how they see the fix working and any changes that, including, you know, whether the window needs to be wider or different from different currency pairs. There's now the opportunity for market participants to provide that directly to WM that wasn't there in the past. So that hopefully will lead, as the market continues to evolve, the fix will be able to evolve with it.
Guy, you talked about the fact that the code is going to be effectively a living code when it's finally finished, so it won't stop in terms of its development. So does the committee have criteria around what will be regarded as a fully functioning market?
I don't quite get the sense of what you meant at the end.
So when you're looking at the code and making changes and adjusting it, what will determine when you have to make changes?
Oh, okay.
Are there criteria that you're going to be looking at that says, yes, this is full of functioning? No, we've got to hit that.
So I don't want to commit ourselves to anything yet because we're still trying to work that out the answer to that question. But and including the structure of how that will be handled. So one possible process, which I'm not going to say is what we're going to end up doing, but one would be, you know, again, I think we'll the opportunity through the various FXCs for market participants to say, okay, if things aren't working, you know, this is an area which needs to be addressed. I would guess that that's got a fair chance of being at least one way that that happens. So it'll be the opportunity for market participants to say, okay, I think, you know, things aren't adequately addressed in this area, it needs some work. The other thing which I think, and again, without committing us to self, to something which we haven't agreed on yet, but I think one thing which wouldn't be helpful is this thing keeps on changing on a high frequency basis, because people have to have some understanding of what's in there and shouldn't be needing to keep on checking every 6 months or so as to whether it's changed. That said, 10 years is probably too long, and so somewhere, one possibility would be as the market, you know, as we notice some new areas of the market appear or new practices appear, address them on a high frequency basis, a higher frequency basis, and then on a slightly lower frequency basis, sort of look for a wholesale review of the code. But I think in terms of how it will evolve in the future, I think it will be very much informed by what market participants are seeing as well as what we're seeing in the market. Down the back.
Guy DeBell, Carrington Clark from Sky News. We've had the Federal Reserve last night indicate that they're probably only going to raise straights twice this year. Markets seem to breathe a sigh of relief on that. We saw them move. Do you think we've seen the end of the heavy volatility that we saw at the start of 2016? But second part of that question, do you think that's probably going to take some pressure off the Australian dollar in the short term? Obviously, it's hovering at a point that maybe the Reserve Bank isn't comfortable with. How do you think that's going to play out?
So on the second question, I can read out verbatim what the deputy governor said last week, because my answer is going to be exactly the same as what he said, which is, every central bank would appear to like a lower currency. Some say that openly and some don't actually articulate it, including possibly Europe from the Fed. But I think most central banks want lower currencies for whatever reason, pushing up inflation or creating a bit more activity. I don't think we're any different from that. But obviously, everyone can't have a depreciating currency. What happens when you have relative prices? So, you know, they said we would welcome a slightly lower exchange rate, like everyone else, in helping the rebalancing of our economy. But obviously, not everyone can have that. On your first question, predicting the end of volatility. I don't know. I'm not sure we're done with volatility for the year, would be my guess. I can think of a decent amount of event risk around about the middle of the year emanating from places in the general vicinity of Europe. I'm not sure we'll necessarily have a repeat of January and February, but I'd, you know, if you're going to go, I don't know, I would certainly not be taking positions betting on the fact that volatility is done for the year.
Can I just ask a follow-up on that, Guy? Are you suggesting the possibility that Brexit could cause an outbreak of volatility?
No, I'm just saying that's not clearly on the calendar. There's a few people, I think it'll be interesting to see how, I think the pressures which come from the immigration wave in Europe, for instance, is another source of volatility. I doubt we've done with volatility in Asia as well. There's still a divergence between the US between market expectations and what the Fed says they're going to do. And then there'll be other stuff which we don't know about yet. So. Any other? Yeah.
Mr. DeWell, Mark Mulligan from the Fin Review. You talked earlier about confidence in markets and confidence particularly in Forex markets after a number of scandals. What you're doing here with the guidelines, will that be sufficient to help restore some of that? And given that it is a global market, and we have disparate national jurisdictions, how do you go some way towards knitting all those together to increase enforcement, let's say?
We're not in the enforcement business, we're in the adherence business. The various securities regulators are in the enforcement business, and I can't speak as to what they might do with this. But as I said earlier, I mean, this is a global code. It's one code for the globe and for all the market participants. So that's the way we're trying to, you know, we're mindful of and have a fairly good idea about how things are enforced differently in different jurisdictions. We have all of the jurisdictions represented on our group. So I think we're reasonably, well, as informed as we're going to be on that. So, and, you know, we're mindful of the constraints we have to operate in there, but doing our best. In terms of the local market, as it, you know, through the membership of the Australian FXC, at least have some leadership from the members of those participants, from those institutions which are there in terms of adherence to the code, and hopefully, and I would expect, rather than hope actually, a broader participation across the market, across the local market. As I said, the contribution we've had from, you know, the discussions we've had with market participants here and the feedback, you know, there was extensive feedback provided on the earlier iteration. As I said, we've got two Australians represented on the global group, and Hugh in particular has devoted a lot of time and plane travel to generate the sort of material we've got today. So, the other thing I would note, I think the other thing which is worth mentioning is that I think the FX industry as a whole, or at least this is what they tell me, and maybe they would tell me this, is that very supportive of what we're doing. There's actually recognised a need for something like this to provide clarity for everyone across the industry, and also one point of clarity rather than what was there previously, which, you know, they're all not all that different, but there were different codes in different jurisdictions. As you said, this is a global market. Makes sense to have one global code, and the general attitude of people in the market is this is very much welcome, and that's reflected in the sort of support we've had from market participants in the process over the past year or so in generating what we've got. So I think that gives me some confidence that there's likely to be good adherence to this, and that the market is behind and work this initiative and working with us in this initiative rather than it just being a more one-sided endeavour. So the fact that it's a cooperative endeavour, I think it takes us to a place where everyone wants it to be rather than one group having to drag the other one kicking and screaming to that point. Right. That's about it. Oh, hang on. Got one more.
Sorry, guy. Craig Betts from Westpac. Just want to ask you what your vision is of how market participants might, how they might interact with each other if they observe behaviour that they believe is inconsistent with the code. So what would a market participant do if they were, you know, observing something they felt didn't adhere to the code?
That's a good question. I think it's probably worthwhile to bring it to someone's attention. Who that someone is, I think, is might have to get back to you on. But I mean, one thing which we're aiming, you know, we're putting this out there so that everyone has a common reference point, so that everyone should be able to say, you know, have a clearer understanding of what is and is not acceptable. And that works on both sides of the market. So it's not just, as I said, this is not just the sell side saying this is how we would like the market to run. It's also the buy side saying this is how we would like, we think the market needs to operate effectively. And given that, one thing we are looking for, though, is some sort of market discipline, which is sort of coming to your point, so that it's not, which arguably could have been there in the past, but doesn't seem to have been. And so one of those things is we've got to find some way of, you know, how that market discipline can actually be articulated and put into practice. So as I said, if everyone's got a common reference point, and I think that makes that sort of conversation a bit easier than it was in the past. So it also, for instance, would allow a sell-side participant to push back on, if a buy-side firm comes to them with a particular order and with a particular way they want that executed, which is inconsistent with the code, and would allow the sell-side firm to say no, and not with any risk of that necessarily harming that customer relationship, because with any luck, all the competitors would also say no to the same question. So I think the fact that there's a slightly more common set of, I don't want to say rules of the game in the sense that they're not rules, but principles of the game out there would hopefully make those sort of conversations in pushing back on inappropriate behaviour a bit easier than was the case in the past.
I guess just to follow up, I did actually send a question through the electronic thing, but it hasn't been picked up.
Yeah.
But as an example, the Banker's Oath has a public register of people who've signed up to that oath, and anyone can go on and see who's paid their little bit of money and signed up to that. Would you be thinking about a public register for market participants who've signed up to the code?
Yeah, so that exactly, yes. As I said, we'll have more to say on this in May. That may well be one of the things we're going to have to say. So, for instance, in the local context, for instance, we would have, I would hopefully expect that the members of the AFXC at least would have signed up to this, but also given that at anyone, you know, we can't have everyone be a member at the same time, we'd potentially look to have some sort of, potentially on the website, these are the institutions in the local market which have signed up to it. So that is very much something which we're considering at the moment, and as I said, by May, probably will have articulated something like that.
We have one more question, and then I think we're going to have to wrap up and move on. One last.
Paul Cotty from NASDAQ. You mentioned that this is a global code rather than a set of rules, and that rules are more the province of the individual regulators. Does that not, however, still allow for some level of regulatory arbitrage? If ASIC interprets something differently from the FCA, could there not be gaps there? And you know, how would it translate across from one jurisdiction?
So I can't speak with that much idea about how individual regulators will either both use this and or interpret it. What I would say is if we're putting out there, so different regulators may take this to a higher level in different jurisdictions, and without, I don't want to say that we're putting out minimum standards because that sounds like, that doesn't sound very lofty ideal, but we're putting out this common set of standards, I think it's a fair way above the minimum, which you would expect all market participants to be following. If different regulators want to take them to different levels above that, that's obviously their own prerogative. I don't think there would be a sense in that people will interpret them differently in a way that which will allow arbitrage. I think it will be more just the different degrees of vigour with which they utilise this. So, you know, I said I can't speak or you know, I can't commit regulators or I can't say what they're likely to do, clearly. But as I said, we're putting out this common set of standards. How people take them above and beyond that may vary across the globe, but I don't see that evolving in a way which would be problematic. As I said, I think what we've got is something which takes the market to a much better place and a place where we want it to be. And if there's some degree of variation above and beyond that, I don't see that. You know, I don't see that as creating any harm.
Thank you so much, Guy DeBell.
Okay, thanks.